Good morning, I'm Jack Brighton, coming to you live on Focus this morning. Science, religion, metaphysics, we like to tackle the easy topics on this show. Coming up on Focus after the NPR News, we'll talk with Curtis White, professor of English at Illinois State University, about his book, The Science Delusion, Asking the Big Questions in a Culture of Easy Answers. He challenges the idea that consciousness, creativity, and culture can be explained by science in a way some prominent scientists and writers have claimed. He says the mechanistic worldview of science limits our understanding of the questions we might be asking about who we are and how to be in the world. And this is coming from a scholar who self-defines as an atheist. We'll explore his argument as developed in the book, The Science Delusion, and take your calls after the news. Good morning, this is Focus. I'm Jack Brighton, and we are live this morning. I'm filling in on the show. Our guest during this hour of Focus is the American essayist and author Curtis White. His novels include Memories of My Father Watching TV and Requiem, and his essays have appeared in Harper's Magazine, Connect, Orion, and Playboy, among many other publications. His 2003 book, The Middle Mind, Why Americans Don't Think for Themselves, was an international bestseller. Today we'll be talking with Curtis White about his latest book, The Science Delusion, Asking the Big Questions in a Culture of Easy Answers, recently published by Melville House. The book challenges the notion that science is revealing the nature of consciousness and creativity, or that it ever could do so, given its inherent limitations in, well, consciousness and creativity. I'm pretty sure I've already badly mangled Curtis White's argument, but thankfully we have him here to present it for himself. It's important to note, though, that Curtis White is not arguing that science is bad, and his argument does not stem from religious convictions. As an atheist himself, our guest takes to task the new atheist view that science has triumphed over and vanquished religion, and that all questions worth answering should be asked in the language of science. We'll talk about that and what it means for our politics, culture, and science during this hour of Focus. As we talk with Curtis White, we invite you into the conversation. You can pick up the telephone and call us at 333-9455. That's the local number. We also have a toll-free line, 800-222-9455, wherever you are listening. You can also go online and send us an email at will-talk@illinois.edu, and also via Twitter at Focus580. So any way that's easier for you to participate, please feel free to do that. I should also mention that our guest, Curtis White, is a professor of English at Illinois State University, and he joins us here in the studio. And thanks so much for being here.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
You focus in the book on particular kinds of claims that have been made by very well-known scientists, that humans are basically products, that the human mind is basically a machine of flesh, neurons, and chemicals. Why, as a writer, why is this important to you enough to write a book about?
The origin of my interest in writing about science is not entirely new. I wrote about it in a book called The Barbaric Heart, with a particular emphasis upon environmentalism. So my interest in the kinds of claims that science makes is longstanding. In this particular case, I was listening to NPR, going down the road happily, and heard an interview with Jonah Lehrer about his new book, or I guess it's about a year old now, Imagine How Creativity Works. And it was an irritation that I needed to address, as often happens with my essays. When he argued that creativity was essentially a brain event involving brain chemicals more than anything else, and completely removing any kind of social context or any kind of artistic traditions from the conversation, those to me were fighting words. So I started the book by writing about Lehrer's book. And unfortunately, about three quarters of the way into the book, Lehrer kind of self-destructed because of certain journalistic sins that he committed in creating quotes for Bob Dylan. But the point, I think, remained quite valid because he's certainly not the only one who attempts to represent creativity and consciousness as a kind of mechanical function of the brain. And I talk about two other neuroscientists in the book, in particular, Sebastian Soong and Antonio Damasio.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot in the book about the ideology of science, or what you term scientism. Isn't the point of science to be independent of ideology, to be objective first and foremost?
Well, that's what they'd like you to believe. I mean, that's part of the ideology of science, is that they don't do ideology, right? So, right. And that's one of the big misunderstandings about the book, is that I for some reason, hate science. I don't know how anyone can read the book and come away with that notion for reasons I hope that we get into. But for me, and this term scientism is one that's tossed about a lot, and it seems to be mean different things to different people. So I make a point of saying, when I say scientism, what I mean is science as ideology. For example, in connection to neuroscience, when they argue that we are, in Daniel Dennett's words, moist robots, that seems to me to go well beyond any kind of substantiable, if that's a word, claim that can be made in scientific terms. There is no empirical evidence that we are moist robots, or no conclusive physical evidence of that. So to me, that's as much an ideological claim as anything else. Why is it ideological? Because the culture itself is so intensely technocratic and regimented and sort of technology driven. So these ideas coming out of the so-called science camp are ideologically or intellectually supportive of a certain kind of culture.
There's a lot of discussion, especially in neuroscience, about, you know, the brain, mm-hmm. and how we're starting to understand how things work, you know, that there are, you know, sort of networks and neurons that fire up and light up, and certain events cause certain emotions or reactions.
Right.
And you write a lot about that in the book as a way of saying this is not, you know, this is not science so much as it is sort of, I'm not sure what to call it, but essentially, you know, it's explaining how things work without explaining how things work.
Right. And it's very funny the kind of evidence that is often presented in order to support those kinds of claims, especially MRIs. And what the MRIs show, of course, is certain kinds of illumination of the brain when certain kinds of activities or certain kind of emotions are felt. But even most of the neuroscientists that were referenced, for example, in Lehrer's book, called those brain events correlatives. But a correlative is not the thing itself, you know. So the question becomes, and it's a question that neuroscience is not ready enough to ask, what is it correlated to? What, in other words, it's not a cause of anything, it's an effect of something. And of course, they don't have the answer to that question, and I doubt that they ever will, because it will require understanding in a physical sense what consciousness is. And that is an impossibility, I believe, because consciousness is not a purely organic or physical thing. It is something that takes place in social structures that are intensely symbolic.
Well, I want to come back to that, because that's a really interesting thing that you get into in the later chapters of the book. I want to make sure we establish sort of, you know, your argument here before we move on to that. The idea of nature as a result of physical or chemical processes, and I'm not sure that, you know, I'm not going to claim that all scientists would claim that. I think I'd like to hear what your take is on that. There, in particular, there are a few people you reference, Richard Dawkins, who writes, you know, sort of, you know, very critically of religion, in the sense that saying science has solved the problems and science is really the ultimate authority, mm-hmm. When it comes to these questions of creation and, you know, evolution and how things came to be.
Mm-hmm. Well, beyond sort of what is apparently a native arrogance in Mr. Dawkins, the problem that I have with what he has to say about religion is that it's so reductive. He and Hitchens tend to reduce religion to this sort of series of criminal anecdotes having to do mostly with fundamentalism. And there's, I mean, the history of religion, as any religious scholar will tell you, is incredibly rich and interesting, both in terms of how various texts came about. The New Testament is not a sort of univocal thing. It's something that is very much a kind of paste-up of positions and arguments that come from a variety of places. And also just sort of the story of the development of Western-style religions, especially Christianity, coming out of Greek culture. Nietzsche called Christianity Platonism for the masses, and there's a lot of truth in that. A lot of the myths, et cetera, that people identify with Christianity are in fact rooted in Greek myth.
You focus your critique on certain scientists. We mentioned Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens, who isn't exactly a scientist but more of a cultural critic writer in general. And I wonder if you could talk about them and why you chose them. Are they representative, do you think, of the fields that they are a part of?
Well, again, you know, since my interest is in ideology, I had to look at the people who were most ideologically powerful, most persuasive. I mean, if Richard Dawkins can call for a reason rally on the steps of the Capitol in Washington, D.C., and 100,000 people show up, that's a reason to look at him in my mind. So, you know, I wanted the book to be comprehensive. You know, I wanted it to take a careful look at and not leave any blank spots. So I wanted to take a careful look at these sort of leading figures. A lot of the things I say about them have been said elsewhere. But as I say, I thought it was important to make a very comprehensive statement that was in book form that would, you know, sort of be a go-to book with the kind of, I'm trying to win, right? I'm fighting back in a sense, you know? So I'm trying to create a statement that is as powerful as the statements made by their books. Now, the likelihood that I will succeed in that, I think, is fairly slim. But that's what I'm trying to do.
Okay. I mean, some of the things that Richard Dawkins and, you know, some of the other cosmologists or physicists, people who are studying the nature of the universe and sort of grappling with the math of, you know, how things came to be and how they have evolved over time. Dawkins in particular seems to argue that there is no there's no plan, there's no meaning, there's no grand beauty to the universe. It just mm-hmm. is. Mm-hmm. And you take issue with that.
Well, yeah. One of the things I argue about that is that scientists don't seem to think that applies to them. I mean, life may be meaningless, but the process of doing science isn't meaningless. You know, it's still very important, and they're excited about it, and they're pursuing all of the awards that are available to scientists. So scientists don't believe that their lives are meaningless because they're doing something that they think is important, which I think is an unintentionally revealing point, because one of the things I claim is that the meaning of life or the universe is that, you know, we're here, we're conscious of it, right? So the importance of sort of human knowledge, human activities, is a sort of de facto meaningfulness in itself. So, you know, the fact that we are the only thing, I go so far as to claim that, along with a lot of philosophers like Martin Heidegger, that we bring being into being, right, through our symbolic activities. Without our consciousness, there wouldn't be anything. I mean, if for no other reason than that there wouldn't be anything capable of the language that would say there's something, right? But, you know, that is a point of view that is lost on most scientists, I think. Although not always, you know. I mean, one of the things that I was very struck by in preparing the book was how many of the early sort of scientists influenced by relativity and quantum theory, how many of them were willing to make statements like that? The universe has more to do with an idea or with ideas than it does with a physical reality.
Yes, you have scientists who basically are inferring, although I think at least the quotes in your book and many others that I've read don't come out and state explicitly that the universe looks more like an idea.
Right. You're right. And I mean, there's a strong current of that in Western philosophical traditions, of course. We call it idealism, and it acquired a really sharp point in the late 18th and early 19th centuries through the work of so-called German idealism, post-Kantian German philosophy, in thinkers like Friedrich Schiller and Friedrich Schelling.
Well, we can talk more about that. Let me just reintroduce our guest this morning on this hour Focus. We're talking with Curtis White. He's a professor at Illinois State University, author of many books, including fiction and nonfiction, and the book we're discussing this morning, The Science Delusion, Asking the Big Questions in a Culture of Easy Answers. If you would like to join us, you can call us around Champaign-Urbana at 333-9455, toll-free elsewhere at 800-222-9455, via that thing called the Internet, on the email, will-talk@illinois.edu, or Twitter, use our @Focus580 handle, and we will include you in the conversation. So language is incredibly important when we start talking about these things, as you point out. And there's one quote that I want to just read from your book. Physics may be written in the language of mathematics, but is a very different thing to say that nature is.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that, if you would.
Too often, I think, there's not enough consciousness among especially popular scientists of, you know, what exactly it is what mathematics is and what it's capable of doing. And too often, I think, at least to my ear, it sounds as if they're saying, I'd like to explain this to you in more detail, but you can't do the science. You know, it's sort of like mathematics is laying out a royal flush and sort of saying, read them and weep. But you don't have access to that language, so never mind. And less emphasis is placed, I think, on the idea that mathematics is what it is, which is a language. It's a symbolic system. I mean, I quote several scientists like Richard Feynman, who acknowledge that the relationship, they know that mathematics is incredibly useful and interesting, but they don't know why it seems to be able to tell us the things it tells us about reality. They don't understand why mathematics seems to be able to model the universe so effectively. But I think that's a really important concession in itself to say that it is modeling, because that's what all language systems do. Is model. So I claim that we are homo analogous. We are that creature that is entirely different from any other living thing that is capable of creating an analogous world to the real world and living in it. Because it works, you know. So if we can propose paradigms and models and then be able to use those paradigms and models in a way that enhances our survivability, then that's a very good thing for us as a species. One of the great heroes of this book is Jacob Bronowski. And in his book, The Origins of Knowledge and Imagination, he argues that I don't know how quite to put this, but his argument is essentially that most of human evolution comes from the stimulus provided by human cultures, not from a desire to be, you know, aggressive or whatever, but, you know, from some genetic meme, as Dawkins would put it, you know, the selfish gene or whatever. Our qualities are not coded in genes They are. But the most important, you know, evolutionary effect upon us is self-created. It comes from our human culture. So those parts of the brain, for example, Bronowski argues, that are so much larger than the similar parts of the brain in other creatures, they have been encouraged to grow larger because of the stimulus of culture for the last million and a half years, a fairly short period of time.
Well, I think it's interesting that this, you talk about creativity and how that then ties into these arguments. And I guess I'm wondering, your case is certainly a very, very strong one, very strongly phrased against the arguments of Richard Dawkins and some of the other people you cite in the book. I was left wondering how representative they are of people in science in general. Science is very big.
Oh,
there are
yeah.
many people in science who are actually studying culture, obviously, as we were just discussing.
Right. I hope they're not representative, frankly. Yeah. I suspect that they're not representative. But my interest in Dawkins is and Hitchens and Lawrence Krauss and the neuroscientists is in the powerful role that they play in culture, in the way we think about each other in a more popular sense. So if ideology can convince us that we're basically just machines anyway, it seems to me that we're less likely to ask questions that challenge the mechanization of the culture. Now, some people, of course, will be bothered by it anyway, the mechanization of the culture, by the assigning to citizens of jobs, for example, that have very narrow skill sets, where people are reduced for the large part of their lives, for example, to doing a fairly narrow set of tasks. So, but there are some people, of course, obviously, the romantics among us, who, in spite of the fact that a Dawkins-like ideology is so powerful, will experience what the romantics called alienation. They won't quite understand why. I don't think anybody understands why in the beginning. They'll simply understand that they don't like it much and they don't necessarily want to limit themselves in the way that we are limited in this very technocratic culture. And so what happens is you get subcultures or countercultures of people voting with their feet and congregating in places like Seattle and Portland, San Francisco and New York, groups of artists usually. And that's an important point for the Romantics, is that this is one of the things that's really misunderstood about Romanticism, is that it's stereotypically associated with nature mysticism or something like that, or it's called an art period. My argument in the book, insofar as it's about Romanticism, is that Romanticism is an idea that has never died. It's always been with us, and it begins not with nature mysticism, but with the idea of alienation, feeling that you're not one with the world into which you happen to have been born. And the way out of that, away from that alienation for romantics, whether we're talking about William Wordsworth or Jerry Garcia, is through art. So art becomes a way of fleeing the dominant culture, which is why I'm so hostile to Lehrer, because he attempts to make art into something that happens basically in the workplace. So, we talk about the new creative economy. And so to me, that's an ideological move in itself, because it tends to distance that notion that what we're feeling is alienation, and our way of responding to it is through the arts. So it denies art that kind of dissidence.
We have a caller to talk with. Let's include them in our conversation. We have someone in Chuck from Champaign on line number one.
Thank you. I'm wondering, in your research for your book, did you come across the living matrix movie, which was a documentary that interviews quite a number of scientists and researchers and science writers as well, that I think largely would back up the very things that you're arguing.
No, I didn't.
Well, I would highly recommend it because it's basically interviews and then illustrations with, you know, really nicely done visuals as well about the ideas of scientists who are researching the field, mm-hmm. field theory, and very much would argue against the sorts of things that, you know, Dawkins the science is really disproving a lot of the things that Dawkins argues. And the Hart Math Institute is doing some interesting research as well. You might check them out.
Mm-hmm.
But, for instance, they interview Bruce Lipton, who is a biologist who his research led him to understand that, in fact, genes are not deterministic. Mm-hmm. And now there's a whole new field called epigenetics where they're understanding that the genes are controlled by the environmental signals.
Mm-hmm.
And not only that, your perception will change the expression of your genes.
Hmm.
So
well, thanks for that.
That is yep. something that I would think would really back up
right.
the arguments you're making. Perception mm-hmm. actually affects genetic expression.
Yeah. I was mostly dependent upon Bronowski for the, you know, sort of rhetorical purposes in the book. And, you know, I'm not a scientist. And so.
Well, yeah. You might want to look into the writings and also the audio work. But science writer Lynn McTaggart,
mm-hmm.
Who's written a lot about field theory and this a lot of the things that are talked about in the Living Matrix
mm-hmm.
movie, which you can actually watch online. You can also get a DVD of it.
But, okay.
I think you'll be very heartened.
Okay.
By that.
Great. Thanks.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much for the call. We are talking this morning with Curtis White about his book, The Science Delusion, Asking the Big Questions in a Culture of Easy Answers. We'll continue talking with him in just a second. And this is Focus. I'm Jack Brighton, your host for this morning. We're talking this morning with Curtis White. He's a professor at Illinois State University.
Retired.
Okay. Well, congratulations. But not retired from writing books?
Nope. That's what I retired for, in order to see what I had left.
Nice. His latest book is A Science Delusion, Asking the Big Questions in a Culture of Easy Answers. And we're talking with him about some of the ideas in that book, and we invite you into the conversation. We've had one caller would welcome others, 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Elsewhere, 800-222-9455. On Twitter, at Focus580, and by email at will-talk@illinois.edu. If that's too confusing, just use the phone. Well, I wanted to follow up a little bit about romanticism and counterculture and the origins of creativity. Before we get into romanticism, let me just ask, you know, we're talking about some of the focus, the scientific research focusing on creativity.
Mm-hmm.
And you note in the book that it's as if the purpose of creativity is to create new commercial products, you know, the rise of the creative class. Let's mm-hmm. have economic development based on creativity, and that this is sort of the rationale for what we mean by creativity.
Right. Well, this is not a new development. I even wrote about it in The Middle Mind in talking about Richard Florida's book on the creative economy. And I think that it won't be any secret to your listeners that that, you know, Silicon Valley in particular is sold as a place for young creative people to go and be, you know, data whizzes or whatever. But I do think it does considerable violence to what art has been. And when the two get conflated, as Lehrer does in the book, by talking about Dylan, who is a very important figure in the book, and Beethoven, as being in some way as doing having the same sort of creativity that, say, someone working in Silicon Valley would be doing. That seems to me to do considerable violence to the function of art in Western culture, especially since the Romantics, because it seems to me that, and this should also be obvious, that art's main function has been dissident. I mean, if you look at the movement of art movements since 1800, they're always, combative in one way or another. If you go through Wagnerianism or symbolism or expressionism, they were all anti-bourgeois. And now this is a concerted ideological effort to make art and creativity hospitable to both the status quo and also to bourgeois commerce.
So are you saying that is antithetical to the actual creation of great art?
Well, I'm saying it's antithetical to the last 200 years of art. I suppose I don't think that's to say that it's antithetical to the nature of art, because I don't know that art has a nature. But it has been a powerful tool for individuals and for social movements to confront, sort of the culture that they happen to have been born into, and to make themselves happier along the way. If you look at sort of the English Romantics, for example, all of them were utopianists, if that's a word. Coleridge and the poet Robert Southey even planned a utopian community in the United States. They were going to move their families over here and start a utopian community that would, be self-sufficient and have an awful lot of poets. And the others, like Shelley, tried to do sort of the same thing in Italy. They were voting with their feet too, but the more important thing about their work was how hostile they were to almost every aspect of the world that they lived in, and how important art was to them as a way of escaping that. Now, the other hero of the book is a romantic critic named Morse Peckham, and he argues that romanticism is essentially human history's second chapter. The first chapter had to do with the founding of cities, and the second chapter for him was this development around the end of the 18th century, where people began to feel that they didn't belong to their city anymore, that it was a place that they didn't like. And so romanticism for Peckham came out of that. And as history's second chapter, it's something that has continued. And I think one of the purposes of my book is sort of to explain to, especially to young people, in places like Portland or wherever you happen to be. Champaign-Urbana certainly has its fair share of hipsters. The sort of historical origins of their own feelings, which they may not understand. Actually, it was only very recently that I came to understand my own countercultural tendencies. I grew up in the San Francisco area in the 60s and was immediately charmed by both Berkeley political culture and by San Francisco hippie culture. So it was only recently that I kind of came to understand, this was all about this second chapter that Peckham talks about. And I don't think it's that something, that sort of self-awareness, why am I the way I am among young people and artists? I don't think that's something that is widely understood, so I'm trying to help with that.
You seem to be saying in the book that alienation and hostility to the predominant culture or the sort of rules of whatever kind that are, bestowed upon the generation coming up, that alienation and hostility is critically important to the evolution of the culture.
Yes, I do think that, although I'm not sure how much I talk about it there. But another philosopher that I'm very fond of, Paul Ricoeur, argues in a book called Ideology and Utopia, that a healthy culture will not only have a strong ideological function, but it will also have a strong utopian function. And the utopian function is basically calls into question everything that the ideological function thinks it knows. So all of the instructions that we receive, and we receive nothing but instructions in this culture. You know, we're told, you know, every step of the way we're receiving instructions upon what it means to be successful, how we ought to live, etc. And the utopian function, which is by and large a product of art for Ricoeur as well, it is there to sort of say no. I mean, say no to ideology and to try to live differently. In other words, it wants to wander away from the straight lines of the dominant culture. So, yeah, it is in that sense. Yeah, art is critically important to sort of social evolution. And, you know, I wish it were more powerful and larger now. It seems to be less powerful and less present all the time.
Well, there are many ad agencies, at least.
Yeah, that's true enough.
I don't mean to be flip about it. I just let me just reintroduce our guest. We have just about maybe 15 minutes left with Curtis White. He's the author of the book we're discussing, The Science Delusion, Asking the Big Questions in a Culture of Easy Answers. And if you want to join us, we have a few minutes left. 333-9455 is the local number around Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, 800-222-9455. I kind of want to go back to, we touched upon scientism and the culture of science, and you make reference to the service that science makes toward capitalism, militarism, environmental disruption. Obviously, not all scientists are in service to those ideals. I would like you to talk about, you know, how that fits into this critique that you have of science as a sort of an ideology.
Well, I would think that most people got into science because they simply were curious about the way in which it reveals, information about the world they live in, about nature or whatever. The title of the book is The Science Delusion, not as a call out to science in general, but as a call out to Richard Dawkins. And I think that, you know, because he has his book, The God Delusion. But the fact of the matter is that in this culture, the bills, which are considerable, get paid for by the state, corporations, and especially, you know, the military. I cite one instance in particular that I found really frighteningly revealing. On an episode of Nova on PBS, they were talking about the development of drones, etc. And there was, a lot of the futuristic plans for where drones are going. And there was a young scientist there talking about these tiny drones that will be able to do various things. And he said, well, of course, we hope that these are all going to be used. My idea is that this is going to be used for humanitarian purposes, to fly up a stairwell when there's a fire in a house or something like that. But he said, we don't always control the ways in which our discoveries and our technology is used. And I'm sitting there going, well, the program was just talking about how the Defense Advanced Research Program is funding most of this drone research. And so I said, you know, you have to be pretty naive to think that you're doing pure science when the person paying the bill is DARPA. And, you know, there's just something unfortunately disingenuous about not recognizing and not taking into account and not taking responsibility for what science work is actually used for.
We had going back to the question of art. We had a caller from Champaign who wanted me to ask, what do you mean by art? You keep talking about art, but do you mean music, painting, sculpture?
All of the above.
Yeah.
Yeah. All of the above.
The question of art and science raises for me another question, and it seems like artists and scientists have have all been demonized many times by scientists, mm-hmm. by societies that feared change.
Exactly. Right. I mean, the book is, towards the end of the book in particular, I talk a lot about what science and the arts have in common, that they're both both champions of change, that what they find most exciting and most, and in a sense, most beautiful is those moments when they have disproved something that they thought was real. And if you wouldn't mind, I could actually, can I read a brief passage?
Sure. Yeah.
Because this is something that has really been strangely misrepresented about the book. So this is about the beauty of science. When scientists get excited about a discovery, their excitement is mostly about the dissonance of their new knowledge. We thought the Earth was at the center of the universe. Well, see this. We orbit around the sun. We thought that man was created in God's image. Well, see this, the fossil. We thought that chemistry was a matter of substances. Well, see this, the atom and its electrons. We thought gravity was exclusively a force. Well, see this, the warp of space-time. Science is beautiful when the confirmation of its theories disconfirms the dominant beliefs of the culture it is working within, or simply disconfirms the intuitions of the human brain itself. The weird science of the last century, weird even to scientists, is the most dissonant and counterintuitive form of knowledge in human history. So weird is the physics of string theory that it seems to have gone beyond anything empirical. Of course, we will not know for some time if this theory is beautiful or merely a great folly, but even if it turns out to be a folly, there is something beautiful and gloriously human about the audacity of its vision.
Same might be said for expressionism or cubism, et cetera.
Right. 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 I mean, both science and art, when they make their sort of their big paradigmatic shifts, are seen as very threatening by, you know, people who are persuaded by the status quo.
I want to talk a little bit about science journalism, because it seems like a lot of the critique that you bring may apply more to journalists than it does to actual scientists.
Uh-huh.
Do you think?
Well,
it's
I don't know. I would just have to make generalizations that I have no real support for. I mean, obviously, Jonah Lehrer is my primary journalist. My suspicion is that science journalism buys in too much to sort of the reigning truths of the physical sciences, and takes a sort of objectivist position. It doesn't look into the kind of things that I look into here, which is the relationship between physical reality and modeling or languages. And this is something that Bronowski is all over. It seems so strange. I really encourage people to read Bronowski's The Origins of Knowledge and Imagination, because it was written in the early 70s. And it, to me, is just a breath of fresh air, because no one's talking this way about science and science's role in social role and its relationship to the arts. Bronowski starts with a poem by W.B. Yeats and then says that the argument he's going to be making in the book is a continuation of Immanuel Kant's argument. You know, so far he hasn't talked about any science. But when he starts to talk about science, he is very scornful of the idea that science has some sort of immediate access to reality. And he says, what we have to understand is that our access to reality is through our perceptions and through, you know, sort of the symbolic machinery through which we look at that world, right? So that to me is like, if this was the position that science ideology was taking instead of the hubristic position that it takes, I wouldn't have anything to say at all. Because, Bronowski in the early 70s was essentially arguing what I argue in this book. But it just seems to me to be gone. I call Bronowski and Peckham, because Peckham was actually a Darwinian, wrote about Darwin. I call them romantic scientists. And I suppose what I'm arguing for in the book is a return of romantic science.
You also seem to be saying that science is essentially, or many scientists anyway, there is a thread that says there's no room for philosophy anymore. We're answering those questions.
It's a very weird situation because some of the leading spokespeople for science these days are so-called philosophers of science. So Daniel Dennett is not a scientist. He's a philosopher of science. Sam Harris is not. Well, Sam Harris actually has a background in neuroscience, but he's professionally a philosopher. So philosophy itself has been made basically to kowtow, and this is not a news story. It goes back to the beginning of the 20th century, where Anglo-American philosophy completely dismissed and threw from the field any connection to so-called continental philosophy, the sort of German and French philosophy of the 19th century, continuing through, the 1960s and so-called post-structuralism. It just threw all that out, called it metaphysics, and said we're now doing things in a way that can be modeled after the hard sciences. But philosophy has already substantially been empiricized, if you will. But the strange thing is how hostile the scientists are and remain even to that form of philosophy, never mind Kant, So it's a very strange set of affairs.
There's one thing there's a quote that you have in the book I wanted to ask you about. You say the superlative irony here is that to imagine we are machines means that we cannot be machines because machines don't imagine.
Mm-hmm.
But how could we know this? What if machines, and I'm using that term very loosely because we're not necessarily talking about erector set parts here, right, can reach a level of complexity where they actually can imagine?
Oh, show me. That's all I have to say. I know that the AI people are all over this, and I say it's a hopeless task because human consciousness is much too much tied up with a very randomizing thing that is symbolic systems. It's not like everything that has to do with thinking is something that takes place solely within an individual brain or the brain as such. It's something that actually I call it transcendental, because in a sense, the symbolic systems in which we live in symbolic systems far more than we live in anything called reality. The symbolic systems in which we live are not one person or one group of people's, possession. It's something. These symbolic systems will survive us. They will change, and they seem to have taken on a kind of evolutionary life of their own. One of the things that I say, sort of echoing Bernowski, is that in human beings, evolution evolved. So it's no longer simply a sort of what works best for the survival of my particular set of genes. It has transcended that and become something strange and wonderful, as Shakespeare might have put it.
Another question I wanted to ask you is there seems to be this current, and maybe it's just my own perception about the way things have, historically been. We have discovered so many things about our world and, our biology and our universe and, the laws of physics and so forth. And sort of an attempt to know everything, mm-hmm. we want to understand as much as we possibly can. And I guess I want to ask you, is it possible to know everything, or can we say that it is or isn't possible?
Well, the everything, of course, keeps changing. If we are creatures who live largely in symbolic systems, those symbolic systems are going to continue to permute, if you will. They are things of change more than anything else. So the nature of that symbolic reality is always going to change, and therefore knowledge about it is always going to be growing or changing in certain ways. I don't think that it makes any sense to try to talk about exhaustively knowing everything about the physical world, because that is one of those kinds of statements that ignores the fact that our only access to that physical world is through symbolic systems, through modeling, through mathematics, through empirical testing, through poetry or whatever you have. And that's exactly what can't be ignored. And that's the thing that Bronowski comes down heavily on in his book.
We have just a minute left, and I wanted to ask one final question. Your last chapter is entitled In Praise of Play, Dissonance, and Freaking Out, and it focused on the romantic idea of a society that maximizes the tolerance for play.
Right.
Now, I've read some of the reviews of your book, and some of them have been pretty negative, not for the ideas you present, but for the way you present them. And I guess after reading that last chapter, I wonder if you feel they missed the point.
I wonder if they got to the last chapter is what I wonder, you know. I mean, given what reviewers are paid these days, I wouldn't be surprised if they just sort of read the first couple chapters and called it a day. I've been called angry quite often, and which is striking to me because there's so much humor in the book. I mean, a sort of by nature a satirist. And because the real forward-moving principle of the book is the ethics of play. And, you know, our culture, I think, really minimizes the freedom to play, especially in terms of playing with sort of social structures, et cetera, or the way that we live our lives.
Well, we're going to have to wrap it up, and there's much more we could talk about, but let me just suggest, if you'd like to know more, read the book, The Science Delusion, Asking the Big Questions in a Culture of Easy Answers, recently published by Melville House, the author, our guest, Curtis White. Thank you so much for being here.
It was great fun.